contentious congressional Republican leadership races, a prosecutor oversight task force, plus an ad in the governor's race, and more. From the television studios at WFYI, it's Indiana Week in Review for the week ending November 18th, 2022.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, Indiana Congressman Jim Banks narrowly lost a race to be the majority whip, the third ranking position in the House. Banks was in a three-way race for whip with Minnesota's Tom Emmer and Georgia's Drew Ferguson. Banks actually led after the first ballot, but fell just short on the second ballot to Emmer, who was elected whip by a vote of 115 to 106. In a statement, Banks pledged to remain a conservative fighter in Congress. Meanwhile, in the Senate, Kentucky's Mitch McConnell staved off a long-shot bid by Florida's Rick Scott to remain the GOP leader. Scott only got 10 votes to McConnell's 37, but one of those 10 was Indiana Senator Mike Braun. In a statement, Braun said Republicans are tired of the status quo and that he backed Scott because he, like Braun, is an outsider. Scott and Braun were both elected to the U.S. Senate in 2018. Prior to that, Scott was governor of Florida for 8 years. Braun served 3 years in the Indiana General Assembly and spent a decade before that as an elected official on his local school board. What's in the future for Banks and Braun? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, editor-in-chief of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, there's a lot of speculation that Mike Braun isn't going to run for re-election for the Senate in 2024 and will instead run for governor. Does challenging the person who's going to be the Senate GOP leader make it more likely that Mike Braun's about to leave the Senate?
It's a strong sign if you want to read it that way. I think it's likely he's going to run for governor anyway. During his time in D.C., he's not been a big rank. You know, he's not been kind of a climb the ladder, you know, kind of D.C. guy who's there to kind of work the system, right? So sometimes that's been great, and sometimes he's had to, you know, navigate around, you know, the hierarchy of the Senate, not being a guy in seniority. So I don't think it's, you know, completely set in stone, but it's certainly an indication that he's just going to kind of be what he, whether he's going to be governor or he's going to be a U.S. senator again, he's going to be his own guy, is ultimately who he always was, you know, in this role, you know, regardless. I'm not sure that, you know, if there's frustration with the institution, the guy who just ran the election, frustration from the election, I don't think, you know, the blame game in D.C. when, you know, whether you win by a little bit, when you're supposed to win by a lot, or you lose, doesn't matter. Everyone's doing this to figure out who's to blame. And, you know, that's been the finger pointing all week between McConnell and Rick Scott. So it was, you know, if you're going to find somebody to run against Mitch McConnell, you'll probably find somebody other than the guy who was running the elections that you're angry about to begin with.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, as, a, you know, Mike Braun's point that, you know, conservative Republicans want an outsider. That's probably true, and Mitch McConnell is definitely not an outsider, the longest-serving Senate Republican leader in history already, and he's going to continue that record. But Rick Scott's the guy? Like, or did was it, in, if you're Mike Braun, you wanted to send a message, and that's just the guy who was standing there?
I think his message was he's not running for the Senate, and I don't think he's running for governor either, because if you were going to choose somewhere to make a stand, I mean, he's an election denier, he's, you know, he's against gay rights, he's against the CHIP project that Senator Young was proposing and is great for Indiana. And then he comes and supports a guy who lost them, that helped lose them the Senate, and lost the election for majority leader, or minority leader, excuse me, minority leader. But on top of that, he is supporting a guy who wants to put Social Security and Medicare and all government programs on an operating table. Okay? So he's coming in there and saying, there's something about Social Security and something about Medicare I don't like when in Indiana there are so many people on both of those programs. I mean, talk about touching a third rail of politics. He's put both hands and feet on it. I don't see him running for anything.
I think he runs for governor, but let's talk about Jim Banks for a second, because this also, if Mike Braun doesn't run for the U.S. Senate again, Jim Banks is one of those names that's talked about possibly running for the U.S. Senate. Does losing a leadership race, albeit a very close one, but does losing a leadership race like this in the House make it more likely that Jim Banks tries to jump over to the Senate?
Yeah, I mean, I thought originally, you know, if he would be the third ranking, he would definitely stay. But I don't know. On one hand, he would get a bigger platform in the Senate. And now that he's not even in any leadership, he's no longer the Republican Study Committee chair because it's term limited. So, you know, he's got to find a new kind of way to work himself into the party. Maybe a chairmanship. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, we've always known that Jim Banks was a rising star in the Republican Party. I mean, since he got to Congress, he's been one of those people. He makes the most of media appearances and that sort of thing. Is the path in the House, I mean, we saw this with Mike Pence. Mike Pence tried to ascend to leadership, got a little further, if you will, right, than Banks did, but clearly saw a ceiling for him there and came to run for governor. It doesn't, I don't hear Banks for governor being mentioned a lot, but is Banks for Senate starting to look more and more likely?
It's possible. And let's make clear, I don't think waging a vigorous campaign to be whip of the party is as precarious or doesn't carry the potential risk or backlash as squaring off against
the leader
yeah, who's currently, one is sort of in your face. Right. The other one, it's almost could be chalked up to, hey, here's an opportunity.
I went out for it.
May the best man or woman win. And in some ways, you could argue, as there's a rich tradition of individuals from elected from Indiana and around the country who have, you kind of have to wage those contests in order to show up on the. Yeah, I mean, and a lot of times it's one of those things where, like, well, he's tried this, he's tried that, so now he's earned his right to. So I don't think that is in any way a death wish the way that the other one.
No, I suppose. Well, I don't think that.
Yeah, exactly. And I suppose we'll see. You know, committee assignments that could also play a role in whether or not he wants to stay there.
Maybe he even propose some legislation that might benefit Indiana. Who knows?
I think he'll definitely propose legislation. I don't know that you'll like a lot of it.
I'm saying benefit Indiana.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question. This week's question, should U.S. Senator Mike Braun run for governor or senator in 2024? A, governor, or B, senator? Last week we asked you, when will Indiana Democrats next win a statewide seat? 45% of you say within the next 5 years, 32% say 5 to 10, and 23% say more than 10 years. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, a state task force charged with exploring what to do if a local prosecutor refuses to enforce certain laws held its first and only meeting recently. The panel talked for about an hour, heard no testimony, and issued no recommendations. Task Force co-chair Republican Senator Aaron Freeman called the meeting a necessary first step to starting a conversation. The other co-chair, Republican Representative Chris Jeter, says the issue will come up during the legislative session.
Look, at the end of the day, it's like, you know, the legislature makes laws and those laws have to be enforced. And if they're not, then, you know, people don't have redress. And I think that's an important issue.
The conversation has actually been happening for a few years, primarily aimed at Marion County Prosecutor Ryan Mears. Mears doesn't direct resources to prosecuting simple marijuana possession cases, and this summer said he wouldn't prosecute health providers who perform abortions. Democratic Representative Matt Pierce says the task force is just furthering a political agenda.
Right now, there's a political attempt to really drive this narrative that crime is out of control and it's a result of Democratic policies.
Considering so much attention is on Marion County, FBI data shows that total property crimes and total violent crimes reported by the Indianapolis Police Force have decreased each of the last 5 years. And Lenny, was there any point to this task force?
Oh, you mean other than slapping Rokita down? Not much, actually. I mean, if you have hundreds of years of tradition of having local prosecutors and local prosecutorial discretion, okay, and then he goes after Ryan Mears, and they spend a fortune trying to put a candidate against Ryan Mears, and it makes a 3% difference in the vote turnout. I think the voters of Marion County have spoken. They don't want marijuana prosecutions for simple possession, and they are not interested in going after doctors who perform abortions. And there are 91 other counties with county prosecutors who want their own discretion, not second-guessed by Todd Rokita. So the point of this was he wanted the power. He wanted the power, and the legislature said no. They gave him a fig leaf, which was this committee hearing, and the fig leaf's blown away.
Well, I don't think it's just Todd Rokita. The Senate has been pursuing this for a while and has gotten it passed, I think, before, or at least gotten it pretty far, and the House keeps, I don't even think it gets a hearing in the House, if I remember correctly. Aaron Freeman, Chris Jeter both said the same thing, which is it doesn't matter what this task force said. It didn't matter what this task force did. There's going to be legislation. It's going to move at least a little bit in at least one chamber. So was there any point to this task force?
Well, there's never, I mean, there can be a point to all of the, you know, an interim study committee or a task force or a commission, but, you know, and there's mixed results for all of these. Ultimately, it's possible, it's an indicator that once you get into the legislative session that the people that are in, that are going to be in the room in the summer are going to be in the room in the winter when they're considering legislation instead of a non-binding task force report. You know, so it's you know, if you're paying attention, it's an indicator that this is really hard. That it's really, there has to be discretion somewhere in the system. And I think, as a Republican, I'd prefer it be at the local level where you have all the facts and context, most importantly, and not statewide politics or some separate body that gets to come in outside of the elected prosecutor and make these decisions. There was, and it's not just abortion and marijuana. Well, first of all, nobody's prosecuting marijuana. It's not just Ryan Mears. But, I'm, you know, there was a laundry list of things that aren't being prosecuted that are simple misdemeanors that have been, Mike Young had a bill 3 or 4 years ago that basically just analyzed all of the misdemeanors that hadn't been charged in years and knocked them all down to civil infractions because it requires balance. Yeah. You'd overload the system. It requires balance. And the best place to do that is with the person that's sitting in the courthouse.
The voters each 4 years.
In listening to this task force, there was one thing that they did seem to agree on, which was as they were trying to figure out what, if anything, they could recommend, they all seemed to agree that they definitely don't want the Attorney General's office taking over prosecution from local prosecutors.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think that's a great point. I was just going to say that even though there were no formal recommendations, there were takeaways, and that is the big takeaway. Because there are other options on the table, theoretically. If there's a conclusion that a prosecutor is in some wholesale fashion not prosecuting a type of crime, what that may be a trigger, but what is the answer or the resolution?
It's the election. That's the answer.
I'm just saying what this panel was looking at. One would be the Attorney General would step in, and then another would be the appointment of a special prosecutor, which there already is a mechanism for that,
right,
existing statute. And so you're right. I think it's clear there wasn't any great, you know, enthusiasm for doing anything at this point, other than there was much more enthusiasm for what not to do at this point. And that is, I think, important and telling.
To that end, you know, they talked about some of these options. They agreed, no, we're not giving to the AG. But they said, you know, well, what about a special prosecutor, as John just pointed out? There's already a system in place, maybe something like that, or something like you could appeal to the Supreme Court Disciplinary Commission, or what if a prosecutor from an adjoining county took over and there was, oh, I don't know about that. But is it emphasizing to Mike's point, is it emphasizing this is still really hard to get through the legislature?
Well, absolutely. They've been talking about it for 3 or 4 years now, and I can count on one hand the people who really care about it. It's like 5 or 6 people who are really entrenched on it, and the rest of the people just don't care. And I think if there's any lesson we can all learn is that if a prosecutor doesn't want to prosecute something, don't talk about it, because if Ryan Mears would just not talk about it, and, you know, then you can't prove that he's wholesale not prosecuting every time.
Right, because they're not talking about individual prosecutorial decision. They're saying only in the cases of blanket refusals to enforce certain laws, which, again, as Mike said, goes on anyway.
And
we just don't necessarily always know about it as a formal policy.
And this is one of those things, though, that could come back to bite you. We've heard a lot of Republican officials say hate crimes, for instance, you know, oh, we're so sensitive. All the snowflakes are concerned about, you know, prosecuting.
They brought up in the committee hearing that there are sheriffs who refuse to arrest folks on gun charges.
Right.
Well, that's the
point.
I mean, just because it seems that abortion and marijuana might fit nicely into one compartment,
yeah.
The others have to be dealt with, too.
Right. Right. With the 2022 election now largely in the rearview mirror, we expect announcements in the coming weeks about Indiana's open governor race in 2024. But there's one person who's been running that race for a while, Republican Eric Doden. And this week, he's trying to get ahead of the pack a bit more. Doden launched his gubernatorial campaign more than a year ago, in May 2021, and since then he's raised more than $2 million. He's spending some of that money now, while he's still technically got the field to himself, on an ad campaign.
I love hearing something can't be done, because I get to work proving it can be done, creating opportunities, and delivering real results.
There are more than 530 days until Indiana's 2024 primary election.
Nikki Kelly, to be quite frank, a lot of people you mentioned, you talk about the governor's race, Mike Braun, some other folks.
How about the lieutenant governor?
Suzanne Crouch is absolutely high on that list of people who would
not
have a serious shot.
Not in the Republican Party, though, because she's allowed to reach the ceiling.
But when you mention Eric Doden, a lot of people go, oh, yeah, okay, I guess. How seriously should we start taking Eric Doden's candidacy?
Well, I mean, no one knows him. I mean, in Northeast Indiana, they know him pretty well. But other than that, no one really knows him. That's what he's fighting. He's fighting against these headwinds of much sort of larger names. And I don't blame him. He's sitting on $2.5 million, and a bunch of people are about to jump in the race. So he's trying to remind people he's in it and that, you know, he's going to be a force. I don't know how much longer he can... Still, I mean, it's one thing to raise money before these other people are in the race, but I think that might dry up as soon as you get a couple big names.
But at the same time, if you can start generating attention to the race because you're the only one running ads about it, even if it's, you know, way far ahead of time, that can help maybe the spigot dries up a little less, right?
I get the strategy, and it makes sense to try to clear out the field and maybe get a head start, especially since you may not have the name ID. Statewide, at least, that some of the other potential candidates do. So I get the fact that he would try to boost those coffers significantly. Now, if you look at the report, I mean, this is not $5 contributions from Joe and Joanne Hoosier. It's his parents, business associates, you know, $10,000 here, $50,000, et cetera, which is fine. Money's
money. It's still money in the bank.
The other thing, though, there are those diehard traditionalists who think it's bad form for, say, a gubernatorial candidate to be active before the intervening sets of statewide elections take place, until the decks have been cleared, so to speak. So I don't know if that's a real issue in this day and age.
Well,
but
I want
to
ask you about that, actually, because maybe there are traditionalists who think that's not the way you do things, but I don't know that matters that much.
Well, nothing matters.
But for the average voter, for the average Hoosier, you just got done seeing all these election ads, and now you see another one. It doesn't sound like this. It's not an attack ad or anything, but now you get another one. Does that actually run the risk of turning some people off?
No, we've been in an endless cycle for two decades. Yeah. I mean, we're not in this off-season environment anymore. We never will be. I've got bad news for everybody. We never will be. But the bad the form and the protocol, I get all that. That's also if you had announced in October, then I think the party people, that was the reaction when Trump was going to announce in October, right? It was it was even the reaction when he was going to announce on Tuesday.
Please
don't.
That's the quaint past.
He didn't announce 2 weeks, try to steal thunder away from people that are actively on the ballot. He did this
May of 2021.
May of 2021, 6 months into or 5 months into Holcomb's second term. So, and that's what you do, right? I mean, Mike Braun can go turn on a statewide gubernatorial campaign tomorrow and put $10 million, seed it with $10 million, and he didn't have to worry about the money side, right?
Suzanne Crouch has got a little bit of that, too, because she's been
a little bit, but she's also been a statewide elected official for over a decade.
The Republicans have a history of letting women go that far, but no further.
Yeah, so do Democrats.
We'll see what happens.
That's true. I want to ask about...
We had nominated a woman for governor, by the way.
She didn't do great.
She didn't win, but we did nominate
John raised the idea of, if you get out there early, you start building your name recognition, maybe you can get some of those people who might have given money to somebody else to give to you. At the same time, though, he's not going to clear anybody out of this space. If you were thinking about running, what Eric Doden's doing now is not going to change your mind, right?
No, that's right. But that's his only shot, is to get out there and prove to people that he's a serious candidate. It's his only possibility, because once the bigger names get in, nobody's even going to think of him. So you've got to give him credit for getting out there and trying.
Right. 4 of the 8 Indiana school districts that asked voters this fall to approve property tax increases to help boost funding failed to get that approval. WFYI's Eric Weddle has more.
8 schools across Indiana asked voters to approve a property tax increase or continue a current levy. But 3 were rejected by voters in rural communities. That's Brown County Schools, Delphi Community Schools in Carroll County, and Medora Community Schools in Jackson County. School leaders said revenue would have been used to fund teacher pay and academic programs. Some staff could face layoffs in the future. Another school district, the MSD of Wabash County, sought a capital referendum to pay for a new high school and other facility renovations. Almost 80% of voters said no.
John Shaughness, we talked on the show a few weeks ago about the things Indiana lawmakers had done to potentially make these referendums more difficult. With these sorts of results, just a 50% batting average in this one, are those efforts at the State House going to die down for a while, or does that not make an impact?
Well, that suggests there's a clear-cut opinion about whether this was a good or bad thing, because there's probably two sides of that equation. Clearly, the School Boards Association has already said it's going to push to to change the way that these things are advertised and sold so that it is based on the median, the actual property tax increase for the median household or assessed value of a household in the county. Because this was hard to decipher. I mean, you see something that says 100 and, you know, I had one case, it was 145%. That means my taxes are going up 100. Or in the case of Westfield, Washington, in Hamilton County, you had a situation where you'd actually be paying less because there was an actual reduction in the levy from what it was, I think it was 65 cents to 63. But, I mean, you don't see that when you look at the numbers. So I think there's going to be some sort of enthusiasm for it to change. But remember, the same people who put these hurdles in place probably don't want to see taxpayers coughing up the money to begin with. So it's not, again, a monolithic opinion among lawmakers on
this. Mike, you've talked about this before. These school referendums are just really hard to do in terms of educating the public about why it's necessary and trying to get enough people to sign up for them. Considering that and considering the economic environment that these voters voted on these things, can you really read that much into these results?
Again, they're hyper-local, and the local school districts that demonstrate a clear need and have a clear need and demonstrate it and articulate that to voters tend to be successful on the first or second try. I think you can read, and that's not to say the other schools aren't running good campaigns or don't have a need or, you know, where these aren't successful, but you really are running political campaigns around, you know, a tax increase. I think the legislature probably leaves us alone this year. There's been a lot of change recently on it, and I think what's hanging in the background of this legislative session is March property tax bills that are coming out with assessments that are reflective of enormous growth in homeowners' assessments and property values that are going to affect their tax rates.
To that point, we've seen now they put in a bunch of changes over the last few cycles. We've seen these results. The lawmakers go, all right, let's see how this shakes out for the next couple of cycles, or at least one, and see if we need to change this.
Well, that would be a sensible approach to take. Will they take that approach? I hope so. I mean, they've made it more difficult. At the same time, they haven't funded them adequately. And these are local decisions, as Mike points out. And if the locals want to do it, it seems to me the legislature ought to just back off and let them do it.
Finally, sad news this week. Indiana lost an icon, while Indiana Week in Review lost a friend. Former state Republican Party chair and regular GOP panelist on iWire, Rex Early, passed away. Rex was a colorful character, I think it can be said, known for his entertaining sayings, likely the most famous of which was, "It's a mighty thin pancake that don't have two sides." Now, Ann Delaney, my question was, what's your favorite Rex Early memory that you can share on broadcast television? Maybe the better question is, is there a Rex Early memory you can share on broadcast television?
I have thought of one.
Okay.
I have thought of one. When we were on Indiana Week in Review, we had a no-prop rule. And Rex was state chairman, and there were seven people running on the Republican primary for the 8th District congressional seat. And he couldn't remember the names. And there's a no-prop rule. So he wrote the names on his hand. The problem was the lights were very hard, very hot, and it started to run. And so the ink came down the hand, and I think he got the first two names out and no more than that.
The rest looked like it was in Latin or something.
That's what he thought, too. So
ink blots.
You're right. He was an icon. He was one of a kind. He loved life. He loved politics. He loved his friends. He remembered his enemies, and he'll be missed.
As any good party chair does, I think.
As every good party chair does.
John,
there's a lot I can't say, of course, but he was one of a kind. I do remember he and Ann used to spar, and he made some point once, and he said, "What do you say to that, Ann?" And she said, "Well, I don't have Rexisms. I can't compete with that." And he said, "But Ann, you've got something just as powerful." And she says, "What is that?" And he says, "Well, whenever you open your mouth and talk, I get aneurysms." And as far as I know, that was unscripted. And so a lot of his stuff was, they were the nuggets that were pulled out of that memory chest, but that might have been spontaneous. But it was great. I looked at the funeral. You look over, and here are his allies, certainly, but also his former opponents. Evan Bayh, Joe Hogsett, Fred Glass. I mean, people who actively were, I mean, literally on the other side of the ballot from him, but appreciated his how genuine he was. You know, as a reporter, I always said my target was hypocrisy.
Or hypocrisy.
But when you are what you say you are, yeah. You can get away with a lot because there's no hypocrisy.
Yeah. That's right.
So he was one of a kind. He'll be missed.
Yeah. All right, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanes of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. You can find Indiana Week in Review's podcast and episodes at WFYI.org/IWIR or on the PBS video app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.